Ngugi Wa Thiong'o is the author of many novels and plays, including Weep Not Child, The River Between, Grain of Wheat, and Matagari. His essay collections include Writers in Politics, Decolonizing the Mind, Moving to the Center, and Pen Points, Gun Points, and Dreams. Ngugi's books have been translated into more than 30 languages. In 2003, he was elected as honorary member of the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Ngugi is currently Distinguished Professor of English and Comparative Literature and Director of the International Center for Writing and Translation at UC Irvine. He was born in Kenya in 1938 into a large family, educated at Makara University, Kampala, Uganda, and at the University of Leeds. As an adolescent, he lived through the Mau Mau War of Independence, the central historical episode in the making of modern Kenya, and a major theme of his early works. Ngugi burst onto the literary scene in East Africa with the performance of his first major play, The Black Hermit, at the National Theater in Kampala, Uganda, in 1962. He published many stories, plays, and a Sunday newspaper column, and in 1964 published his novel, Weep Not Child, which was enthusiastically reviewed. The year 1977 forced dramatic turns in Ngugi's life and career. His first novel in 10 years, Petals of Blood, was published that July. The novel painted a harsh and unsparing picture of life in neo-colonial Kenya. It was received with emphatic critical acclaim in Kenya and abroad. The same year, Ngugi's controversial play, La Kahika Ndinda, I Will Marry When I Want, written by Ngugi Wa Meriri, was performed in Lamura with the workers and peasants of the area as actors. Sharply critical of the inequalities and injustices of Kenyan society, publicly identified with and unequivocally championing the cause of ordinary Kenyans, Ngugi was arrested and imprisoned without charge in a maximum security prison. In prison, he wrote the novel Devil on the Cross on toilet paper. After Amnesty International named him a prisoner of conscience, an international campaign secured his release a year later. He was barred by the state from jobs at colleges and universities in Kenya. He resumed his writing, however, and activities in the theater. Ngugi has continued to be an uncomfortable oppositional force for the Mao dictatorship, the Moi dictatorship. While Ngugi was in Britain for the launching of Devil on the Cross, he learned about the Moi regime's plan to arrest and imprison him without trial, or worse, eliminate him. This forced him into exile, first in Britain during the 1980s, and then in the United States after 1989. His next novel, Matagari, was published in 1986. Thinking that the novel's main character was a living person, the Moi regime issued an arrest warrant for him. On learning that the characters were fictional, it had the novel arrested instead. Between 1986 and 1996, the book could not be sold in Kenyan bookshops. When Ngugi and his wife Njeri returned to Kenya in 2004, after 22 years in exile, they were attacked by four gunmen and narrowly escaped with their lives. Ngugi has continued to write prolifically. He is recipient of many honors, including the 2001 Nonino International Prize for Literature and 7 honorary doctorates. Please welcome a writer who is not only a world literary treasure, but in a time when one doesn't use the term lightly, a hero, Ngugi Wa Thiong'o.
heroes. My wife, Mombi, our daughter, and Theon. My wife and I both work at UCI. She's the director of the faculty and staff counseling center at UCI. And Theon always, on an occasion like this, he normally speaks before me because my name is Gowan Diomo, so traditionally, symbolically, he is my dad. but today he has a bad cough. But I'm afraid he says hello to all of you. Can you shake your hand? you know, I really appreciate your being here tonight and to share of here our readings. I always take it that the artistic process is never complete, really, until the reception by, you know, readers, you know, by until received by, you know, people like the audience we have, you know, here, you know, tonight, you know. So I take it that my reading today is part of that, you know, artistic process. And I really appreciate you are taking the time from your very busy to come here to listen to us. Now, I want to read from my latest novel, Wizard of the Crow. I'll read four pieces, you know, from the novel. Before I do that, you know, I want to just explain the setting a little bit so that you and I are on the same page. The novel Wizard of the Crow is set in a post-colonial fictional country somewhere in Africa. But the issues it deals with are, of course, of global dimension. In fact, I normally call it, you know, a global epic from Africa. It's rather lengthy, you know, 800 pages, but you can be sure I'll not read the whole thing. As I said, the novel is set in a fictional, you know, African country called Afraria, and one of the main features is a post-colonial dictatorship. I was really fascinated with the kind of dictator who emerged in Africa in the 20th century, particularly after independence. And I had in mind people like Amori of Kenya, you know, Mobutu of Zaire, Congo, Idi Amin, Bokassa of Central Africa. But I also drew features of this particular dictator in the novel here, simply called The Ruler. I also drew from dictators like, you know, Pinochet of Chile, Marcos of the Philippines, and Suharto of the Indonesia. What I found very fascinating about the dictators was the fact that they were literally sponsored by the West, Western democracies, in their struggle in the Cold War, you know. So they functioned literally as an arm or ideological arm, you know, of the West or Western democracies, you know. But of course, they came into being because of conditions within those countries, obviously, you know. But what happened with the dictators, they became like the proverbial genie, which if you take it out of the bottle, it's very difficult to put it back, you know. So that they became loose cannons, not really accountable to anybody, not to their own people, certainly, and not even sometimes to the West in terms of being able to return into the bottle at the command, you know, of the very people who put them there in the first place, you know. The dictator I have here, called simply The Ruler, he and his sycophants They want to build the tallest building in the world. In fact, if you have heard, and I'm sure you have heard, of the biblical Tower of Babel, which the Israelites apparently did not complete, he wants to complete that project so he will be a neighbor to God. So, hi, neighbor. You know, how did you sleep today or last night? That kind of thing, you know. You know, but the only problem is that he had to get a loan from the global bank and to be sanctioned by the global ministry of finance. And of course, the people who are going to pay for this loan are the citizens of Afraria. The children of their children of their children of their children, generations to come, will be paying for this project, which here is called Marching to Heaven, and which will be presented to the leader or the ruler simply as his birthday cake. Okay. The project obviously is presented to him by his sycophants, because a dictator of any kind, African, Asian, European, you know, American or whatever, surround with sycophants, you know, people who are always competing with each other to see who can become more sycophantic than the other. The other thing about dictators, particularly the ones I'm talking about in Africa and third world generally, is that they do not always obey even their own rules. They are always breaking their rules, you know. So a sycophant might be playing by today's rules, then tomorrow he finds the rules are changed, so that even a sycophant might find that he is a victim. So the sycophants have to keep on being more sycophantic, and they are always, you know, sort of living sort of in fear themselves in case the rules have changed. The section which I'm going to read to you, which I'll begin to read, is I'll start with when the plan for marching to heaven is being announced. Okay, so the ruler sits in front, and his sycophants are beside. So the section I'm going to start by reading is the one which describes the people in front of with him. To the ruler's right sat the minister for foreign affairs in a dark striped suit and a red tie with a picture of the ruler, the emblem of the ruler's party. The story goes that Marcus used to be an ordinary member of parliament. Then one day he flew to England, where under the glare of publicity he entered a major London hospital, not because he was ill, but because he wanted to have his eyes enlarged to make them ferociously sharp, or as he put it in Kiswahili, Yahweh machukari, so that they would be able to spot the enemies of the ruler, no matter how far their hiding places. Enlarged to the size of electric bulbs, his eyes were now the most prominent feature of his face, dwarfing his nose, cheeks, and forehead. The ruler was so touched by his devotion and public expression of loyalty that even before the MP returned home from England, the ruler had given him the Ministry of Foreign Affairs so that Machokali would be his representative eye, wherever, in whatever corner of the globe lay the ruler's interest. And so Machokali, he became, and later he even forgot the name given at birth. To the left of the ruler sat another cabinet minister, the minister of state in the ruler's office, dressed in a white silk suit, a red handkerchief in his breast pocket, and of course a party tie. He too had started as not a particularly distinguished member of parliament, and he probably would have remained that, except that when he heard of the good fortune that had befallen Macho Kali, he decided to follow suit. He didn't have much money, so he secretly sold his father's plot and borrowed the rest to buy himself a flight to France and a hospital bed in Paris, where he had his ears enlarged, so that, as he also put it in a press statement, he would be able to hear better and therefore be private to the most private of conversations between husband and wife, children and their parents, students and teachers, priests and their flock, psychiatrists and their patients, all in the service of the ruler. His eye ears were now larger than those of a rabbit, and always primed to detect danger at any time and from any direction. His devotion did not go unnoticed, and he was made Minister of State in charge of spying on the citizens. The secret police machine known as M5 was now under his direction. And so Silver Sikioku, or Silver Big Ears, he became, jettisoning his earlier names. Now, other members of parliament would have followed suit and had their bodies altered depending on what services they wanted to render the ruler, except for what befell Benjamin Mambo. As a young man, Mambo had failed to get into the army because he was small in size. But the fire for a military life never died, and now, with the new avenues of power opened by Macho Kali and Sikioku, he thought this his best chance to realize his dream. And for days and nights, he agonized on the best bodily change to land him the defense minister portfolio. He chose, after agonizing, to have his tongue elongated, so that in echoing the ruler's command, his words would reach every soldier in the country and his threats to his enemies before they could reach the African leader borders. He first emulated Sikioku and went to Paris, but there was some misunderstanding about the required size, and the tongue, like a dog's, now hung out way beyond his lips, rendering speech impossible. Macho Kali came to his aid by arranging for him to go to a clinic in Berlin for corrective surgery, where the lips were now pulled and elongated to cover the tongue. But even then, not completely, and the tongue protruded now just a little. And then the ruler misread the signified and gave him the Ministry of Information instead. Well, this was not bad, and Mambo marked his elevation to a cabinet post by changing his forenames and called himself Big Ben, inspired by the clock at the British House of Parliament. His full name was now Big Ben Mambo. Now, I come from Kenya, although I live here in Castle, California now, and the language situation in Kenya is that we have our mother tongues, then we have Kiswahili as the lingua franca, and then English as the official language of power, of administration, education, and so on. And in this novel, I want to illustrate how I utilized that complex linguistic situation for certain subject effects in the novel. But I also want to illustrate something else. In a dictatorship, or a dictator lives not only by culture of silence and fear, but also he effects that through equating himself to God, literally. All the symbols of power or images projected on television are attempts to reinforce that equation with God. I understand, for instance, when Mobutu of Zaire used to appear on television, he would send, you know, through the clouds, you know, as really God. Now, how then do you cope with a dictator? I think what people do is also they deconstruct the dictatorship in their imagination through jokes and stories that bring about the absurdity of the dictator. And I want to try and illustrate that, you know, here in the novel Wizard of the Crown, the section you're going to read next. Minister Machokali was waxing ecstatic about how the benefits of the project could trickle down to all citizens, you know, a kind of trickle-down economics, you know. Once the project was completed, no historian would ever again talk about any other wonders in the world, for the fame of this modern house of Babel would dwarf the hanging gardens of Babylon, the Egyptian pyramids, or the Great Wall of China. And who would ever talk of the Taj Mahal? Our project will be the first and only super wonder in the history of the world. In short, Machokali declared, march to heaven was a special birthday cake the citizens had decided to bake for their one and only leader, the eternal ruler of the Free Republic of Afrelia. Here, Machokali paused dramatically to allow time for innovation. No ovation, except for members of parliament, cabinet ministers, officials of the ruler's party, and the representatives of the armed forces. Nobody clapped. But nevertheless, Machokali thanked the entire assembly for their overwhelming support, and he invited any citizen eager to say a word in praise of magic to heaven to step forward. People stared at one another and at the platform in stony silence. The only hands were raised were once again those of the ministers, members of parliament, and officials of the ruler's party. But the minister ignored them and appealed directly to the citizens. Is there no one of you able to express his joy in words? Or are you so overwhelmed by happiness that you are lost for words? I know that you can try. And then a man raised his hand, and Machokali quickly beckoned him to come over to the microphone. The man, clearly advanced in years, leaned on a walking stick as he pushed through the crowd. Two police officers ran rushed to him and helped him toward the microphone near the platform. Aid, you see, was still revealed in Afrelia, and the multitude waited for his words as if from an oracle. But when the old man began to speak, it was quite clear that he had difficulties in pronouncing Swahili words for the ruler, Mtukufu Raisi, calling out instead, Mtukutu Raisi. Horrified at the ruler's being called a cheap excellency, one of the policemen quickly whispered in the old man's ear that the phrase was Mtukufu Raisi, or Raisi Mtukufu, which confused him even more. Coughing and clearing his throat to steel himself, he called out into the microphone, Rahisi Mukundu. Oh no, it's not a cheap asshole. The other policeman whispered in the other ear, No, it is His Holy Mightiness, Mutukufu Mutakatifu. Which did not help matters, because the old man now said, with what the old man thought was confidence, Mukundu Takatifu. At the mention of his holy asshole, the multitude broke out in hilarious laughter, which made the old man forget what he had wanted to say, and he stuck religiously to the phrase Rahisi Mukundu, which made Machocali quickly signal that he be removed from the microphone. The old man did not understand why he was not being allowed to speak. And as he was led back into the crowd, he let out a stream of Rahis Mukundu Mutukutukutaka Tivu Mukundu Tukutuku in the combination of cheap and horny assholes. He thought might work, gesturing toward the ruler as if begging for his divine intervention. Section and then I'll do the last one. But this one is, at one point, the ruler comes to New York. He comes to New York because wants to meet the Global Bank functionaries or directors of the Global Bank to make a case for marching to heaven. But he also wants to address the United Nations General Assembly, because this project is so unique that he wants other leaders to be aware of it. Now, he stays in... have you been to New York? How many have been to New York? Oh, almost everybody. Good, yeah. So you know Manhattan, and you know Fifth Avenue Hotel. Fifth Avenue, which is the one which divides, you know, east and west, okay? Now, he's staying in a hotel, in Fifth Avenue Hotel. Fifth Avenue is a fictional hotel, of course, but I call it Fifth Avenue Hotel. It's near VIP Fifth Avenue Hotel, near Washington Square, you know, facing, of course, surrounded by University of New York University, where for 10 years I was also a professor of English, of comparative literature and performance studies. But anyway, what then happens? The ruler begins to expand, you know. And what's really happening is that the clothes he's wearing are in tatters. He's expanding proportionately, you know. So they try new clothes, they become tatters, you know. They try everything, in the end, they can only cover him with sheets, you know, become like a shroud, you know, and he's still expanding. The other thing which they try is to get a doctor, obviously, to come and see what this is all about. So Father was try a doctor around New York called Clement Clarkwell. But when he tried the temperature and everything else, the man is normal. Okay, nothing wrong. This puzzles him very much, and he realizes, oh, I must get help from his professor, or the other one who taught him all this business of medicine. And so he calls his previous professor, Professor Dean Furyk from Harvard. And Dean Furyk comes from Harvard to help him. He's especially in obesity, but even he is puzzled because temperature is normal, the blood, the stool, everything is absolutely normal, but the man is expanding. The ministers then figure, what do we do now? These Western doctors cannot cope with this disease, although we are in the middle of the West, New York, you know. So they secretly import a sorcerer from Africa. But they have a problem. Or they import a wizard or a crow from Africa. But they have a problem. Because they are trying to show, they're trying to show that they are modern. So the first thing they want to make sure is that the two sets of doctors do not actually meet, you know, okay? But when Wizard of the Crow comes, the first thing he says, he must see everybody who has been in touch with that body. Which of course, you know, another thing, by the way, that although the body is expanding, he, the ruler, has lost speech, capacity to speak. He cannot even talk to tell them about his illness. Anyway, so the minister in charge of the whole program now goes and tells the infuriated professor from Harvard that he's wanted to appear in front of who? A doctor, asked an astonished Furyk after Machocalli had summoned him. Machocalli allowed that the man was specialist, yes.
Yeah, specialist.
Oh, no. He's a spiritualist. Yeah! He's a spiritualist. But only after many probing questions did he finally admit that he was talking about a witch doctor. What? A sorcerer in New York? An astounded Furyk asked. And here I'm going to quote from the diary which Furyk kept about this strange illness, and which, by the way, came to my hands. I'll not tell you how, but it came to my hands. Okay? So I put from the diary. I looked at Machocalli to reassure myself of my sanity, he wrote in his diary, and I found his big eyes begging me not to reject the summons. So instead of giving a sounding no, as I had intended, I found myself telling him not to worry. Well, he is a doctor of the mind and I of the body. So, well, between us, we should make a dream team. I was simply trying to calm him down, even as I grew curious. I looked forward to meeting the man who seemed to have a hold on this Western educated, high-ranking government minister. But as I was about to enter the man's room, I wondered, how would we communicate? With hand gestures? Imagine my surprise when I encountered a witch doctor who spoke English as if he had been educated at Harvard or, well, or near Harvard. I said to him, "You speak excellent English. Where did you learn the language so well?" He said, "At the University of Treetops." Well, I had never heard of that university or seen it cited anywhere. He asked me, "What about you?" "You speak excellent English. Where did you go to school?" Quite frankly, I was a little irritated by both the question and the tone, for could he not see that I was white? Whatever did he expect me to speak? "So, Harvard, of course," I said curtly, and asked him, "So, in your country, they teach sorcery and witchcraft at the university level?" He replied, "Oh, yes. The art and science of witchcraft are the core of the university system of Treetops. We have both teaching and research departments that specialize in magic." "What about you?" "Don't you?" "Of course not," I said. "Here we have departments of medicine and psychiatry and pharmacology." And I quickly changed subject and told him how glad I was to meet him to discuss the strange illness that had befallen their leader. A strange malignity, this self-induced expansion. Rare. Never, ever had it before. Yes, that was it. And I suddenly realized that I had given a name to the oddity. SIE. Self-induced expansion. Now, at one point, Wizard of the Crow manages at least to release the ruler's speech, but not expansion. But when he comes out of the room, he finds Dr. Dean Fury and Clement waiting for him. And when he tells them that he has managed to do what they have been able to do to release the man's time, Dean Fury is not very happy. "You are fraud," he said, wagging a finger at the Wizard of the Crow. "You are claiming success based on my work. I discovered the illness and even gave it a name. I challenge you in the name of science to a race for the cure for self-induced expansion. But I warn you, the patient is mine. And I'll patent the patient, the name of the illness, and any cure." So that's, you know, he's claiming intellectual property rights. And he and his partner Clem form a company called Clem and Dean, and they want to patent the body of the ruler. But they find a little hitch because, okay, although we encountered a hitch in patenting the patient or even his body, because the name ruler was too general and to have meant that we had patent rights on all the bodies of all the rulers of the globe, we were satisfied with the rights to the discovery of self-induced expansions. "I will now use all the latest gains in the Human Genome Project, cloning and stem cell research to come up with a cure. Science versus sorcery. The battle between me and the Wizard of the Crow was shaping up as one between darkness and light. And I felt connected to a long line of Christian soldiers all the way back to the Holy Crusades." And the last bit which I want to read is actually a short piece, but it's quite important, this one, because really it's about you. Haha, you didn't know that, did you? You are also in this story of Wizard of the Crow. And where are you? Oh. You are there, don't worry. I'll get you. Right. I wanted to help me here, actually, you know, because to be able to read about you, I want to jog your memory a little bit. So I wanted to remember that day. I don't know whether it was a Sunday or a Saturday. I don't know whether you were walking in the streets of Los Angeles or wherever, or whether you're watching a movie or in the room together watching TV or whatever, you know. But remember that moment, all of you, remember when you felt suddenly that although you may have known this person for a bit of time, but now things seem to have changed. The ambience was different. The voice of your partner sounded more melodious, wise. Everything seemed to be just right. And you realized something was happening, opening out. And this is a passage I want to read. And please have your experience and this also in mind as we go down memory lane to that moment. Here I'm describing two characters, Nyawira the woman and Kamete the man, and they are both their main characters. They form the opposition movement in the novel. They run a movement called Movement for the Voice of the People, because the question of voice and silence and recovery of the voice and agency is very important in The Wizard of the Crow. They were told that they too, Nyawira the woman and Kamete the man, were like-minded in so many ways. They often punctuated their talk with songs, stories, and friendly banter, such as when they came across a cigarette and then a field mouse. They stopped and in unison sang about the animals, zebra, rat, and field mouse once went to a granary of an in-law to feed and out came nine goats of youth to count ten. It was a song that helped them count up to ten, but the logic was in the rhythm instead of the meaning of the words. Once again, they laughed together, and as they looked in each other's eyes, they were suddenly without words. So they resumed their walk in silence, taken up by the light they saw in each other's eyes. Love was everywhere. It was there in the tree branches where the nests of weaver birds hung. It was there in the fern where the widow bird had left two long, black, tall tail feathers. It was there in the murmurings of the Elderless River as it flowed eastward before turning into a roaring waterfall. It was there in the sun's rays which pierced through the waterfall, splitting into the seven colors of the rainbow. It was there in the still waters of a small lake made by the river, where Kamite and Nyawira now swam and bathed and chased one another, splashing water on each other. It was there in the black jacks, the goose grass and other plants, the flowers and the seeds of which stuck their wet clothes. It was there in the movement of porcupines and hedgehogs. It was there in the wings of the helmeted and crested guinea fowls, francolins that scampered away after stealing glances at the couple. It was there in the honeybees and butterflies, hopping from flower to flower. It was there in the cooing of the doves, in the making calls of the river frogs from among the reeds and the water lilies. Love was there among the creeping plants that twined around the tree trunks. Yes, it was there in the blackberries, some of which they plucked and fed to each other. Love was there in the breeze that made the leaves sway ever so gently. Love was everywhere in this forest, but neither Nyawira nor Kamite mentioned the word love. Thank you. Thank you very much.